Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Chicago and earned an engineering degree at Purdue. He joined the Navy, became a pilot, and was named an astronaut in 1963. He spent 566 hours in space. He's the second American to walk in space, dangling by a tether while going 18,000 miles an hour. He's one of only three men to ever voyage to the moon twice, and he's the last man on Earth to ever walk on the moon. His name, Captain Gene Cernan. And I'm Jack Grasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Grasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Captain Gene Cernan, the 12th and last man on Earth to ever walk on the moon. Captain, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Jack, it's certainly a pleasure to be here. And after that introduction, how can anyone believe anything's impossible? You know, when you said those things about me, and I was thinking while you were talking, and I wonder whether you're really talking about me. Did that really happen? But in fact, the life is, I know it did. So if I can do that, anybody can do anything.
Can you talk about your childhood and your parents?
Well, I just, typical blue-collar family. Grew up in the western suburbs of Chicago. I have one sister, an older sister, and I think the first time we always rented a house as a kid growing up. I grew up, I'm a product of World War II, grew up during the war, and the first house I think we were ever able, I remember Dad, I was too young at that time, but Mom and Dad lost a house during the Depression, and mm-hmm. I was one of those Depression babies, I guess, that wasn't expected to come around. And the first house I remember we were able to afford was called a war house, maybe 1,000 square feet, two stories, basement. And I grew up in a very modest world as a child, but I didn't lack for anything. My dad's ambition, his dream in life was for me and my sister to get the education that he and Mom never really had an opportunity to get. And my dream as a kid growing up in those days was to fly airplanes off of aircraft carriers, and I guess we both were able to achieve our dream and reach our goal.
What did your dad do?
Dad was he was one of those guys in those days. He could do everything. I mean, he could build a garage, fix a toilet, rebuild an engine on a car, and we did all those things, and we did them together. I remember as a kid working with Dad a lot on weekends doing those kind of things. I guess he had a high school education. I think he had to finish at night school. But he became eventually, before he retired, which was far too young and his life came to an end, he was the foreman, a night foreman at a place called the Naval Ordnance Facility in Forest Park, Illinois. They built torpedoes for the Navy, and so he was, I guess you could call him a machinist by trade, but he grew up running that whole facility in the evening. It was a naval facility, so when I did graduate from Purdue and got my commission in the Navy, he paraded me around in my new uniform among all those other naval folks who were there. Actually, a Navy captain was a Navy's a part of the torpedo facility, and I remember at that point as an ensign, I thought a captain was God. And I guess maybe at that point in time, like a Navy captain to me was God.
So, why did you become a pilot?
It was a dream I had as a kid. We all have, and I urge kids to do this. I urge them to dream about what they want to do and what they want to be. I never had a chance to fly as a kid. I didn't wash airplanes, and got my license at 16. The first time I ever was in an airplane was about my senior year in college. but watching those unsung, anonymous, now famous aviators from World War II, some of the folks out there may or may not recognize the names, Joe Foss, Tex Hill, Bob Hoover, some of those people who can make airplanes do what I call the impossible. But mostly I watched people. As a kid growing up, we went to a movie once a week. Movie Tone News, black and white. Television was just barely coming in to vogue, and that was actually even after World War II. And we'd watch the goings on in the Pacific or in the European theater during the war. And I watched these guys fly our planes off aircraft carriers. And as a kid, you know, 7, 8, 9 years old, I said, that's my dream. That's what I want to do. And as far away as that, as far-fetched, you talk about impossible, as far-fetched and as far away as that was my dream as a kid. And you know, that led, the only way to do that was to fly in the Navy. And my goal growing up, you know, I'm a typical kid, made model airplanes, did all kinds of things like that. Never lost sight of the fact that that's where I wanted to go. That's what I wanted to do, and that's what I wanted to be. The thought of being or flying in space at that time was strictly in the comic books.
You were once strapped in the cockpit of a burning helicopter at the bottom of a river. Can you share that with us?
Well, you know, that was during my days in the space program after I'd flown a couple times, and I was backup commander for Alan Shepard on Apollo 14, and it was about a week before the launch, and we used a helicopter to do some training. Like we used other high-performance aircraft to do training for our space flights, and the helicopter gave us some vertical conditioning for landing on the moon, and I was just burning down some fuel and down in Florida and sort of, I guess, flat-hatting, flying too close to the water, and caught a skid of the airplane, and it tumbled over and crashed, and it was one of those things, unfortunately, that was of my own doing. But believe it or not, when I found myself on the bottom of that river, I felt like I'd been there before because my Navy training took me there before. And fortunately enough, I did the right thing at the right time and was able to get out. I felt like one of those John Wayne movies when a merchant ship is torpedoed, when all the flaming gasoline is on fire. I came to the surface, and that's what I found, and had to you know, swim under it and eventually got out of it. But I survived. It's one of those dumb things we all do in our life, and unfortunately, I came out pretty well after that one. Learned a lot, thought a lot about it, but I still do some dumb things once in a while.
We're talking to Captain Gene Cernan, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Captain Gene Cernan, who was one of 14 astronauts selected by NASA in 1963. When did you get that dream, Gene?
Well, I was in the Navy. I'd been living my dream. Went to the Western Pacific flying off aircraft carriers, flying fighter and attack aircraft, jet attack aircraft, and all of a sudden came the original seven, Alan Shepard, John Glenn. This was after Sputnik, and I remember I was in San Diego. You never dreamed that I could be one of those. Never, you know, space was still the impossible dream, truly the impossible dream, and I was pretty content and excited about what I was doing, and day Alan Shepard flew, I was in San Diego, and someone said, Gene, how would you like to do that? And I said, you know, God, I'd love to do that. I'd love to go into space. I was sort of protected by the fact that I'd never be able to get there. I said, but by the time I get ready, by the time I get good enough, by the time I have the experience that these guys have, there won't be anything left to do. All the pioneering will be over. And I think about that a lot, and I try and relate that to young people. Don't ever count yourself out, because it was almost, and I didn't know Al Shepard at that point in time. I was just 20, 25-year-old young hotshot naval aviator, and within about 10 years, I stood next to that same Alan Shepard, that same American hero, that same first American in space. And I stood next to him, not only as his equal, as a backup commander to Apollo 14, but I had already flown twice, walked in space, been to the moon, and he had still only had 16 minutes of space flight experience. That truly says anything. Anything is possible. Never count yourself out.
Gene, the vast majority of great astronauts were not Air Force pilots, they're Navy pilots. Why?
Well, you probably get an argument from my colleagues in the Air Force. But, you know, if you look at it, the first American in space was a naval aviator. The first American to orbit the Earth, John Glenn, a Marine, wore Navy Wings of Gold. First American on the surface of the moon was a naval aviator. The last American to leave his footprints on the surface of the moon, naval aviator. Five out of six lunar landings were commanded by naval aviators. And the seventh, Apollo 13, was commanded by a naval aviator, and it didn't land. I don't know how to explain that, and I've never tried. It just happens to be a fact that history bears out. And, you know, it obviously, I think we're all equal. Air Force, Navy, Marines, we're all the same. I think there's a tremendous amount of capability in all the services and all the people who fly airplanes. But maybe it's the way we're trained. Maybe it's the carrier aviation that has a significant influence and makes a difference. I don't know. There were truly a lot of great Air Force astronauts and great Air Force pilots. It just turned out that the majority of the command positions, for some reason, were given to naval aviators. I can't explain why, but quite frankly, I'm pretty proud of the fact.
What's the toughest thing you've ever done?
Well, you know, I guess there's a lot of things when it comes to flying. There's when it comes to flying, it's a no-brainer. It's landing aboard an aircraft carrier at night. You know, when you land on the moon, you got thousands and thousands of people in your corner helping you get there from here. You're landing. You've got the control sticks in your hand. No one's doing it for you. And, you know, if it doesn't happen, it's your fault. Nobody else's. And it truly is a challenge. And you're a long way from home, a quarter million miles away from home. It's a different environment. But, you know, when you're strapped into that airplane, coming aboard an aircraft carrier in the darkness of night, in the rolling seas of the South Pacific somewhere, I tell you what, that's where the rubber meets the road. That's where you and your maker have a conversation and talk about it. Because I don't think anything I've ever done compares to that in my entire life.
You were the second American to ever walk in space. You were out there for 2 hours and 10 minutes. You spanned the circumference of the world twice while out there. What went right? What went wrong?
Well, Jack, we didn't know much about what we were doing at that point in time. It seems we should have. We didn't know. We didn't take into account a lot of Mr. Newton's laws for a reaction. There's an equal and opposite reaction in the zero gravity of space. That becomes very pronounced. The simple answer to your first question is what went right? Not much. What went wrong? A lot. A lot so much that, you know, we might not be having this conversation if things hadn't eventually gone my way. It was a very difficult task to learn how to operate and work in a zero-gravity environment without the proper footholds and tools that I needed. But, and we had, prior to my experience, we had 20 minutes of spacewalking experience. Didn't tell us a lot. You know, the doctors were worried also, I'm going to get space euphoria. I'm traveling at 18,000 miles. I'm a human satellite. Am I going to feel like I'm falling? None of that really happened. But my problems were problems that were solvable. And in retrospect, I think I looked at Gemini 9 as a failure at the time. I felt like I'd let down my colleagues, didn't get the job done. But in retrospect, we learned so much about what we didn't know and what we had to do and what we had to learn from Gemini 9 that I think it truly probably very well have been a turning point, a cornerstone in our effort to learn what we were doing on our way to Apollo.
18,000 miles an hour, you're hanging from a tether. Could you tell you were going anywhere near that fast?
Well, I could. I could look over, you know, I'd take three giant steps and I crossed the Gulf of Mexico and crossed the United States and from California, actually from Hawaii, where I first got out of the spacecraft, opened the hatch, and until I crossed the East Coast was about 15 minutes. If you look at the ground, you can certainly feel and see, you know, see the states and the coastlines go by pretty quickly, obviously. But actually, your world is up there. I was moving relative to the spacecraft. I felt very content, very comfortable with where I was, very frustrated, actually, with what I wasn't able to do because of the zero-gravity environment. You know, it's like if you took a Coke bottle and held it out in front of you with one hand and tried to unscrew the cap. You know, you have to have both hands on something like that, and it was a relatively helpless and frustrating feeling to be out there. I guess the biggest problem is when I got pretty well tired, pretty well worn out, was getting back in the spacecraft, and it was very small. It was like putting a champagne cork, me being a cork, back into a champagne bottle. The bottle being the spacecraft. It was a pretty difficult task, but we made it. We got in, and in retrospect, as I say, I look at it as probably one of the most promising moments of my days in the space program.
When we come back, we'll ask Captain Gene Cernan about the 75 hours he spent on the moon. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
We're talking to Captain Gene Cernan, the 12th and last man on Earth to walk on the moon. Gene, when you landed, what was that experience like?
Well, you know, Jack, having been there before on Apollo 10, actually we came close. We didn't land. I took the lunar lander on Apollo 10. I tell Neil Armstrong that we painted a white line in the sky so he wouldn't get lost on the way to the moon. But we went down about 47,000 feet, came close, but our plan was, the plan at that time was not to land. And so on Apollo 17, there are two things. I had two goals. Number one, I wanted to command my own crew. I didn't want it, not to give orders. I just wanted a responsibility. I wanted me to be responsible for the success or failure of that mission, and particularly being the last mission, I wanted it to be a great success. And covering that last 47,000 feet into a valley, we landed in a valley that was surrounded by mountains on three sides higher than a Grand Canyon is deep. And when we finally touched down, that whole 14 minutes of that powered descent, and I'm unbeknown to most people, we flew the vehicle. It was not automatic. I landed. If it was going to land, I was going to make it land successfully. And we noise and vibration, and we landed, and all of a sudden it's just quiet. You look out the window, and the dust is cleared. And you realize you are now where no man has been before. What you are looking at has never been seen with human eyes before. Those mountains, which towered on three sides around us, were spectacularly. We call it magnificent desolation, but there's got to be more descriptive terms even than that. And then eventually, when we worked our way out and got down to the surface, it's, you know, once you make that first step, it's something nobody. Nothing can ever take away from you. Once you make that step on the moon, it's yours. It belongs to a lot of other people because a lot of other people made it possible. But you just happen to be the one, the lucky one who happened to be there. And it's an overwhelming experience to look out. You're standing in sunlight surrounded by the blackest black, not darkness, but blackest black you can conceive in your mind. And out there, sitting on top of the mountains in the southwestern sky, is the beauty of our Earth, multicolored blues of the oceans and whites of the snow and the clouds. It's an awe-inspiring experience. It's overpowering, and I'm not going to go back, unfortunately, but I do take myself back there vicariously many, many times.
Did you take any item to the moon, or did you bring back any memento?
Well, I took a lot of things, obviously, myself. But, yeah, we were able to take not a lot, but a few of our own personal mementos, things for your wife and your children. I took some pictures of my family. I took my mom's rosary beads and brought them back to her. We took some medals and a couple other special things and truly took them down to the surface with us and then brought them back.
We're talking to Gene Cernan, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're talking to Captain Gene Cernan, who spent 75 hours on the moon. When you were on that moon and you looked at Earth, what did you think about?
Well, you know, the first thing you have to ask yourself if you... Is this really happening? Is it a dream? You pinch yourself. Am I really here at this very, at this moment in space and time and history? And obviously you are. You don't take it for granted because you've got a lot of things to do. Time is your greatest asset because you're simply there, and it's your greatest enemy because you never have enough time. But notwithstanding all the experiments and the geology work you've trained for and the things you've got to do, you can't help but look over your shoulder and realize and attempt to realize where you are, attempt to take it all in. And I'm not sure you do consciously. I think you think a lot of it is subconsciously. You know, as you go back to when you leave the Earth, you leave the Earth at, you circle the Earth at 18,000 miles an hour, and you fire off that third stage of that big Saturn V rocket and you accelerate to 25,000 miles an hour. And I say that and I listen to myself say I've been to 25,000 miles an hour four times in my life, two going and two coming back. As incredible as it sounds, it really happened. And you look back at the Earth, and when you're in Earth orbit, you fly over a coastline, a city, maybe if you're lucky you fly over your hometown. You fly through a magnificently beautiful sunrise and sunset every 90 minutes, 16 of them every 24 hours. But when you leave the Earth and you head out for a rendezvous somewhere in space with something, with another body in this universe we've chosen to call the moon, and you look back, things do become different. There's two different space programs, both technologically and I think philosophically, because you no longer fly through a sunrise and a sunset every 90 minutes. You look back and watch them happen simultaneously on opposite sides of the Earth. You don't fly over a city in a lake or a river or coastline. You look across oceans and continents, and you watch a world whose horizon was slightly curved in Earth orbit now close in around upon itself, and all of a sudden you're beginning to realize you are moving away and looking at the world grow smaller very, very quickly. A very strange and yet familiar sight. You've got to contemplate. You got to take all those things in. And, you know, and 3 days later, that Earth gets so small you can literally cover it up with nothing bigger than your thumb. You can blot out your identity with reality with something smaller than the palm of your hand. And when you're on the moon and you realize that you're no longer, you're on something solid, when you step on the surface of the moon, it's something other than Earth. You can walk... You can climb the highest mountain on this planet of ours or walk the depths of the deepest ocean, and you're still on Earth. Now, I was walking on something solid that wasn't Earth. It was another body in the universe, and that was home out there a quarter million miles away in all its splendor and all its beauty. I've always felt science and technology got me to the moon. They put me on a plateau. And I could explain how I got there, but I could no longer explain to myself not only what I was seeing, but what I was feeling when I was looking back at the Earth, because it's just too beautiful to have happened by accident. There's got to be somebody bigger than you and bigger than me, and that's not meant to be a religious statement, spiritually perhaps, but there's somebody, a creator of the universe, because I was privileged to stand on the front porch of God and look back at a small part of his creation, a creation that was just too beautiful to have happened by accident, too much purpose and too much logic. And that may be the most memorable, deeply embedded memory I have of any other experience I've had of going to the moon, is looking back and trying to comprehend the significance of the existence of the Earth and the universe itself. And I cannot overemphasize this blackness I talk about. It's the endlessness of time, the infinity, endlessness of space, endlessness of time. And I can tell you exists because I saw it with my own eyes. I could almost focus on it. And it surrounds the Earth, completely surrounds the Earth, standing in sunlight looking at the Earth surrounded by blackness. a paradox on Earth, but happens to be truth on the moon. If I could stand every human being next to me, every human being on this Earth today, for 5 minutes, and put them on that same plateau, put them on that same porch that I stood on, and look back home, I think the world might be a different place today.
This morning, I'm driving. It's 8 a.m. It's a beautiful blue sky in Detroit, and I see the silhouette of the moon. When you see the full moon, Gene, in the morning or at night, what do you think?
Well, you know, I don't really. I look at it, and I maybe passing thought. You know, I've really been there. It's home. I know what's up there. I don't often spend a lot of time dwelling on it unless people ask me what you just asked me. What do you think? But not only I can feel, I can transport myself there. I know what it means to be there, and I know what it looks like to look back at the Earth. We have seen ourselves now on this Earth. Those first pictures from Apollo 8, when they took a picture of an Earthrise coming over the lunar horizon, we have now seen ourselves differently, perhaps as only we've imagined through the writings of poets or images of artists or minds of philosophers. We have now seen ourselves on this planet differently. I don't know what that means. I'm not sure we'll ever understand the significance of Apollo for another 50 or 100 years, but we have left. We left over a quarter century ago. We left this planet and lived and called another planet in this universe our home. Impossible. What's not possible if I can go to the moon before half of your audience was even in diapers? But when her mom and dad were young kids, I've gone to the moon, called it my home, lived there, and I'm back here to talk about it. Jack, truly, anything is possible if we can do that.
How has technology changed in these last 35 years?
Well, you know, the unfortunate part of it is I heard someone say it would probably take us twice as long to go to the moon today as it did back in the 60s, and they're probably right. Technology will allow us to, you know, we can't do it any more safely. There's only a few ways to get there from here. But miniaturization plays a big part. We can do it with more redundancy. We can do it probably with more automation. But the fact is, when we do go back, we're going to send humans back again, and we're going to expand our presence on the moon in preparation to eventually having someone talk to you or someone who follows in your footsteps about what it's like to look at the Earth from Mars. And I can tell you that is going to happen. That truly is possible. And that goal is certainly within our reach.
What did you say when you were leaving the moon?
Well, everyone remembers Neil's comments about one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. And, of course, the press wanted to know what I was going to say. And quite frankly, I didn't know what I was going to say. It was going to be, no one was going to remember it in any way. And I tend to think about things based upon the environment I find myself in, and I came back up with some words as I crawled up the ladder, something like we now leave as we once came, and God willing, as we shall return with peace and hope for all mankind. And then I said, when I got to the top of the ladder, I said, may America's destiny of today. May America's challenge of today be man's destiny of tomorrow. And what I was trying to say there is that Apollo has challenged mankind. It's an adventure that all of mankind was included in involved in. And I really think those first steps we've taken during Apollo to go to the moon truly will be the foundation of the foothold, the cornerstone of man's destiny in the future. We are destined to explore. We all seek knowledge. We all want to know who we are, where we came from, where we're going. And it may be 50, it may be 100 years, but our destiny is to explore and seek knowledge and answer some of the questions that we all have had for millenniums.
We're talking to Captain Gene Cernan, who spent 23 and a half days in space. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible, on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Captain Gene Cernan. Gene, in your opinion, what is courage?
Boy, that Jack, that's a tough one to define. You know, we all react to circumstances differently. What makes a Medal of Honor winner? What makes a guy crawl out of a foxhole and charge a pillbox? And, you know, a lot of those things happened in the past in World War II. A lot of those things are happening in Iraq today. A person's got to have a strong belief in himself. He's got to have a strong belief in what he is doing and why he's doing it and where, you know, I didn't go to the moon not to come home. I don't know if that took courage, but I wanted to do something that I thought would make a difference. I wanted myself to make a difference to people. And I think courage is one of those spontaneous things that that comes from a certain inspirational basis, but it comes from the unexpected things that have come about in life. I don't think it necessarily takes courage to walk on a tightrope across a mountain pass or drive a motorcycle 90 miles an hour. Sometimes that's maybe just the opposite of courage. It's one of those innate things that has to be somehow bred into you when you're growing up, 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 years old. It has to be something I think you inherit from your upbringing, from your parents without even knowing it. People ask me who my hero is today, and you know, it's without question, it's my father. But unfortunately, I didn't know it until you know, maybe even after he passed on. It's something you just somehow subtly inherit, and it's the manner in which you respond to situations.
Tonight is Father's Day. Why is your dad your hero?
I'm sorry?
Tonight is Father's Day. Why is your dad your hero?
Oh, yeah. Tonight's a special day. I think all fathers are special, and, you know, we all look at our fathers differently. I don't know. My dad created a certain level of discipline in me. He used to tell me something. He said, "I don't care what you do, whether it's in a classroom, on a football field, wherever it may be. Just do your best." He said, "And nobody else. I can't. Your teachers, no friends can ever ask anything else of you than to do your best." But remember, he'd always told me this. There's a caveat. But remember, there's only one person who knows what his best really is, and that's you. And he said, if you do your best, you're not going to be better than everybody at everything, but sooner or later, the cream is going to rise to the top. Sooner or later, you're going to surprise yourself with what you can do if you're willing to try. And he was right. And that's another thing I try and pass on to youngsters. Don't be afraid to make a mistake. Golly, I've made all kinds of mistakes in my life. Because if you're afraid to make a mistake, then you'll be afraid to try. And if you're afraid to try, you'll never know how good you can be. And that's a message I think that young kids need to hear. There's too much peer pressure about embarrassment and making mistakes in one thing or another. And, you know, I'm not saying take an undue risk, but we can't afford to be a risk-averse society. If we believe in something and we believe in going to the moon is worth the effort and worth, quote, the risk, let's minimize the risk and get on with it and do what we want to do and make it happen.
You wrote a book, The Last Man on the Moon. What's the basic message of the book, Gene?
Dreaming, I guess if I had to sum it up, would be dream the impossible and then go out and make it happen. Dream the impossible, and then go out and make it happen. That might be a good summary explanation for the whole book. I wanted to share my experience. I wanted to answer the questions that everybody had, you know, and they weren't the technical questions. They were the questions that are as prevalent today as they were 30 and 40 years ago. How did you feel? What did you think? Did you feel any closer to God? Were you scared? What does it look like? the kind of questions that everybody wants to vicariously understand and relate to. And I wanted to share the answers, my feelings, my personal feelings. It's not a technical book. It's not even a space book. It's just sort of a personal adventure book of a kid who grew up with a dream of flying airplanes and one day found himself standing on the moon and calling the moon his home. Little did I believe that would ever happen, but the fact is it did. That's why I go back to the, you know, dream the impossible, and then by golly, go out and make it happen.
Speaking of God, what role has faith played in your life?
Oh, I think a significant role. I think, you know, if a person finds themselves without faith and belief in something, that they've got to be pretty empty, and there's not many explanations for a lot of things. We don't have all the answers, and that's what I said earlier when I was standing on the moon. Science and technology could not explain to me what I was feeling, what I was seeing. A belief in the supreme being, you know, we're all privileged to worship. Most of us are all privileged to worship in whatever way we like, to dress our God in any manner we want, call him by any name we want. But there's no question in my mind, but there is a creator of the universe, a God, a supreme being, who gave us a certain amount of intelligence and to do with our lives what we want to do. And I guess like everybody else, I tend to lean on that God, on my God, when I need help. I'm not bashful to tell you I said a few Our Fathers and Hail Marys just before we lifted off the surface of the moon. Now, whether that helped or not, I don't know, but I'm here to talk about it.
You've achieved so much. What are you the proudest of?
I'm sorry, Jack.
You've achieved so much. What are you the proudest of?
Oh, Jack, I don't know that I've achieved that much. I was just one of those guys who was in the right place at the right time. I guess if I had to focus on one point, it's being on the surface of the moon and having the privilege of saluting the flag of my country, the Stars and Stripes, and realizing that it's people who were challenged by JFK over four decades ago to do something that most thought was impossible, that most thought couldn't be done. He challenged us to go to the moon when we hadn't even, barely got off the ground on Alan Shepard's flight. Challenged us to truly do the impossible. And I was just an intro, and I was the tip of the arrow, and Apollo 17 was sort of the climax of that challenge. I was able to say thank you to put the American flag on the surface. That's the ultimate dream, to be able to do something you believe in very strongly. And if it weren't for having, I guess, been brought up in a family I was brought up in, nothing special. Well, yeah, it was special, but nothing unique in terms of affluency or anything. And have the opportunities I had, second generation Czech and Slovak background, to come to this country and be able to share with you and to your listeners and to a lot of millions of other people about an experience that I've had that truly belongs to them is the one of the greatest rewards a human being can receive in his entire life.
Captain Gene Cernan, this has been a fantastic, unbelievable hour. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for all you've done for this country. And thanks for being with us.
Jack, thank you. It's a pleasure. Bye now.
Our guest next Sunday will be Daddy Rich, Coach Chuck Daly. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Swahili.